Welcome back to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. With us today, we are really pleased to have Michael Harris. He is the author of The End of Absence, Reclaiming What We've Lost in a World of Constant Connection. This book has been quite the read, not only for me, but for everyone who picked it up. It brought into light exactly how much of our lives we're wasting away, staring at phone screens, iPads, laptops, instead of spending quality time with quality people that we actually care about and getting the skills that we need to really live. And the skills to be alone. It is very true that some people just don't know how to spend time alone. Why is it that we're always seeking constant communication and seeking constant connection, but now we're not seeking it face-to-face, we're seeking it on the internet? Are we more attached to our phones than to people? Listen to the show. Michael, welcome. Your book, for me, was incredibly relevant. And I want to start off by taking a statement which you made. Technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. And that quote, I think, was from Melvin Kranzberg. What does it mean by it's neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral? What is it?
I'm glad you brought that up. I've actually had a couple fights with people about that quote, because for some people, it doesn't make any sense. But it might just be a question of semantics, you know? If technology is neither good nor bad, that means we can't ascribe a moral attitude to it. However, it's not neutral. That means it can still do things in your life. It can still have an effect. And that effect may be a positive or a negative one. The idea is to get away from thinking my toaster wants to toast bread. My phone wants to distract me. We take the agency away from our technologies and put that agency back on ourselves.
And we put the agency back on ourselves in what form?
Well, I mean, it means that we start making decisions about the ways that we interact with our technologies.
Right.
Specifically, our social media technologies, I think, is the big one. We have to make decisions like, I'm going to batch process my email, maybe, or I'm going to walk to the grocery store without my phone today. Just little daily decisions like that.
So if I said it, I would probably say technology can be good and it can be bad, but it can never be neutral.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could put it that way. But my point, and I think Kranzberg's point, is just we don't want to give we don't want to think that technologies have it out for us. We don't want to come from a position of paranoia.
As opposed to the paranoia, like the we're going to make robots and they're going to take over the world and the computers are going to eliminate human beings,
right?
That kind of thing?
The Matrix vision. It is possible that we will be subsumed by our technologies in the future. I'm not saying that's not possible, but what I'm saying is that if that happens, it'll be our own damn fault. It's not the technologies that have some kind of
absolutely. It would be our vision. Fault because we're the ones who build them and we're the ones who tune them up and program them, right? So
mm-hmm.
I completely agree. Though, to what extent do you feel as if I'm 60 years old, and my kids are very technology savvy, extremely, but I think their children... My kids are in their 30s. Their children, if they choose to have them, are probably going to grow up with technology from the day they're born. So they
right.
really don't have that choice because now tests are taken, you know, over the internet and so on and so forth. So
then it gets to this question of how do you explain water to a fish, right? You're talking about the first generation in history that is going to be completely digitally native and for whom separating themselves from the internet is not actually going to be an option. It'll be a sort of the air that they breathe.
I wonder if that's... Let's let's go to the name of your book, The End of Absence. Explain, number one, what made you write the book, and what does it mean?
Sure. Well, why did I write the book? 2 years ago, well, 2 years ago, I guess it's 3 years ago now, I was working as an editor at a magazine. Like a lot of people who work in magazines, I had, you know, three screens in front of me at all times. I was really like a screen junkie, and I was spending more time moving content around and refereeing a Facebook page than I was actually producing pieces of writing that I was proud of. So the things that I thought I was going to do as a journalist really don't exist anymore for most journalists out there. So I had this kind of breaking moment when I was looking at maybe 12 different windows on these different screens at once and realized this isn't my life. This isn't something had fundamentally changed when I wasn't looking. So that was the impetus to write this book. I want to figure out what changed. What was the big difference that I'm 35 years old. So what had I witnessed in going from life before the internet to life with the internet? And to the other part of your question, the title of the book, The End of Absence, that was the big thing that I thought had changed, that we had lost solitude and daydreaming, reverie, all those little empty squares of our lives that the internet seems to kind of elbow out of the way. And the book explores kind of chapter by chapter where those absences went and why we might want to get them back.
Now, it's interesting, Mike, because what you just said is that the internet has caused us to not have those little squares of introspection and daydreaming and creating. But now, without even meaning it, you attribute it to the internet as opposed to our choice to use the internet.
No, it's a constant trap, right? We're always, I mean, yeah, if I wasn't on a radio show right now, I might write it down in more careful prose. yes, we could say the internet gives us the opportunity to indulge in our baser desires to such and such and such, right? But the end result is we have these very human urges to connect with other people and to be distracted. Those are basic animal desires that we have, and we have built for ourselves this fabulous media environment that capitalizes on those desires or allows us to indulge them to a degree that might not be healthy. The same way that we have now a food diet that you know lets us get very fat.
I completely agree with you. I mean, 100% agree with you because, you know, growing up for me was, at a very young age, was go outside and play ball with your friends. And then later on, you know, coming from that kind of 60s, 70s generation, everyone hung out. It was all about face-to-face communication. The thing with the internet is that one is that it becomes instant, so people literally don't know how to communicate one-on-one. And the other problem that I have with it is that there are lost skills because we're taking information from the internet as this is the absolute truth when it's just someone's opinion. You know,
the difference between those two realities is sometimes difficult to explain to somebody who's a digital native, like your grandkids that you were mentioning.
My make believe grandkids.
Your make believe grandkids.
Yeah, my kids are 37, 32, and they're only make believe.
Okay.
The kids are real.
Excuse me.
We're gonna cut that out.
That'll be the part we edit out. Yeah.
Exactly.
I was talking with a digital native just yesterday. This guy who runs a tech startup. He's maybe 25 years old. He's very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and he was asking me, "What's the problem with spending more of my life interacting with avatars than with real people?" And I had to take this huge step back that the assumptions I was making about the value of face-to-face communication, those aren't necessarily the same assumptions that somebody who grows up online is going to be making, right?
You're right. And here's though, someone who hasn't grown up online, I remember, you know, when I took computer classes, it was those big cards. And like one of my first, one of my jobs when I was going to college was running this IBM system that was the size of four rooms that now could be done with, the iPad. But there is a difference because you control the avatars. And in real life, you have to learn how to control your interaction. And you're in many ways more vulnerable because you can't shut off real life, but you can shut your computer off.
I think that's absolutely true. It's a huge part of why people are drawn to dealing with avatars. It's safer. Most teenagers that get interviewed about these things, they talk about texting versus voice-to-voice conversations because they have control over the conversation, right? And this creates a kind of a preciousness or a fragility around social interactions. And I think it does encourage people to be afraid of the chaos of real lived experience in
right.
a way.
So Michael, let me ask you this, because, you know, first of all, you got a great voice for radio. You should be doing this.
It's only when I got a cold.
No, you are like this with a cold. You have another career ahead of you. But let me ask you this. They do it because they don't think it's dangerous. It is as dangerous as heroin, because what happens is they are losing skill sets that they will, if they don't develop, they're never going to be successful, and they're going to be viewers of life and never livers of life. They're never going to live life. And the second, you know, part of that is this need for instant gratification, which life doesn't give you, but you can have it on the internet. So their ability to be patient, to wait, to contemplate, to think, they may not see it as dangerous, but it is hugely dangerous. Other thing in terms of loneliness, I don't think, you know, the Japanese, they have robots that you could buy very expensive as a wife. Now, that may not be the worst idea, but in reality, it's not the best idea either. Okay. So, but in truthfulness, you know, if you have a little bit of differences in your life and everything is not so easy, you're going to be tougher, stronger, and I think enjoy life more. I think they're numbed out.
You know, I tend to agree with you. I'm 35. I live right on that straddle.
That cusp.
Between that cusp between online life and offline life. So I've kind of been on both sides of it. But I would remind you at the same time, you know, if you were a kid walking down the street and ran into Socrates back in the day, he would complain about the invention of writing. And he would tell you that you kids writing all of your words down, you were losing the oral tradition and you were destroying your brains. And this is something that goes throughout history. The more you read about it, the more it stays the same. Every piece of communication technology that we've invented for thousands of years has been met by people like me writing books about how this is the end of the world, right? So while it is the end of the world, I think it's very important to remember it's also the dawn of a new one. And your grandchildren or your imaginary grandchildren are going to be multitaskers in a multitasking world, right? Yes, they wouldn't do very well in a 1950s office, but if you took somebody from a 1950s office and put them in 2020, they wouldn't be able to get a job either.
Well, you know what? You happen to have picked my favorite philosopher, who's also the name of my dog, my boxer, Socrates. Hello, Socrates, if you're listening. There is the one thing that I need to point out is Socrates. It was called the Socratarian curse. He was unable to write. His mind was only able to communicate because he actually was close to schizophrenic to a certain extent. He never bathed, and under his clothing there were basically lice. And even though he's my favorite philosopher of all times, but he did allow Plato to take everything down.
Yes,
you know. So yes. I know that he could not do it, but he also knew that the written word, if we're going to get his philosophy out, which I still think is one of the most brilliant philosophers I've ever read, you have to write it down.
Well, and this is the thing. No matter how critical we become of our communication technologies, we never stop using them, right? Because they always are going to speak to that very fundamental human part of ourselves. I'm on Twitter. I'm talking to you on an iPhone right now. Life doesn't stop, right? We don't go off into the woods and become Unabombers, most of us. We don't go off in the woods and become Thoreau in his cabin either. We stay connected. That's what humans do. And yes, change is happening at this frightening pace, but in the end, we're going to buy in at least partly, I think.
I agree we're going to buy in, but I want to emphasize, I think it is a false connection. I remember, this is a memory going back, obviously, like 47 years, you know, talking to this girl who I liked on the phone. I don't know how old I was, but maybe fourth grade, third grade, fifth grade, whatever.
Whoa.
And, I started very
starting in early.
You know, and after like 5 or 6 weeks, she said, listen, are you one of these guys that all you want to do is talk and we're not going to meet up? She says, just tell me now, because this is going to be our last conversation. You know, and I had to decide whether or not I really wanted to meet her or not, because the phone was so easy. This is what I see in this generation, is that people are not even going, the internet dating sites are dying because no one wants to make the effort to actually meet, and no one has the skills.
I don't know if internet dating sites are dying, but absolutely on dating sites, on hookup apps, you are finding people who are they're playing the app like a kind of game, a game of communication, instead of realizing that there are actual human beings behind it. I've written on gay sex culture online and the ways that people become dehumanized through viewing them just through these avatars, almost like you're playing with playing cards.
I can't agree with you more. You're so right. And you're right. It's, you know, hookup sites are not communication sites, you know, and you're right. We are in many ways, what we're doing is developing a very narcissistic society because we're gaining a sense of control through technology, but in fact that control is really false. And it is so easy to write something bad about a person. It's so easy to try to destroy someone's life, because once you're accused of something, you could defend yourself, but then everyone's saying, well, of course, he's just defending himself. That accusation can't be taken away. It's like, you know, people get bad reviews very often for restaurants or whatever, because it's their competition to write it, but it never goes away. So what happens...
No, the veracity of reports online, you're right, and things like Yelp, you know, people are hiring a click farm in India to give them 4,000 likes on Facebook.
Exactly.
This kind of thing is happening all the time. Yeah. So rather than being totally doom and gloom about it, though, I think it's important to remember there are all these steps we haven't taken that we can take to improve our media climate too, right? Like, for example, there are almost no histories of media being taught in high schools. I don't understand that at all. We teach people the history of war and the history of literature, but we don't teach them about the history of the lenses through which they see the world. I think from kindergarten on, we should be teaching critical studies in media.
I am not kidding when I say that your book should be mandatory reading in education. And that's, I'm not trying to kind of, you know, falsely compliment you. I actually believe that, because not only are we not taught these things, the history of media, we're not taught, you know, the upside and downside of media. You know, we're not taught how to develop a individual imaginative. We're not taught to have an imaginative life and create something, and that's what the frontal lobe is there to do, is to create. So I completely agree with you. The basic human skills are not being taught. And I want to go back to something you said, because it was really so important. Core fears, there are just only a few core fears that lead to all anxiety and all fear. And one of the most common, it goes the fear of death, the fear of dying and illness. But the most common is the fear of embarrassment, the fear of not fitting in, the fear of being inferior and lonely. And the internet feeds that too, because people will cut you off for the silliest things because there's no real deep relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So that's
no.
A concern.
I mean, I was just reading a study this morning that was showing, and maybe this is obvious, but they've proven it now, that people who have social anxiety, people who are at risk for being nervous about whether or not they fit in, they are the people who are the most problematic Facebook users, meaning they are the ones who are going to use Facebook so much that it actually impacts their ability to do work, or so much that they might do poorly at school.
I so agree.
So, you know, again with that, I mean, I'm anthropomorphizing again, but these are social media technologies that have figured out how to capitalize on that very human need to groom each other, or rather we as their creators have figured out how to capitalize on that need.
So I want you to tell that really cute story about your nephew Benjamin. So so tell the story even with your cold.
Even with my cold. So, well, there's a couple stories about Ben in the book, but are you talking about the one when he meets his grandma?
No, but you could tell that too. But I like the one where he puts his finger and tries to zoom in on a magazine cover.
Okay, yeah. No, we were sitting around in the living room, and Ben, who at the time was maybe two, he picks up a copy of Vanity Fair, and it's got, you know, Bradley Cooper's smiling mug on the cover of it, and Levi. Sorry, I just said his real name. His real name's Levi. Starts spreading apart his fingers on the magazine cover, as though to zoom in, and then he looks up at me and kind of holds up the magazine to say, "This is broken." And he,
we're doomed.
You know, he taught me in that moment that a magazine is just a broken iPad to a 2-year-old, right? That,
but that's the point. We are so fucked. Meaning because he, like, he's entered into a make believe world that everything's supposed to work or it's broken. And if it's broken, throw it out and get something new.
Right. But is that fundamentally different though from you waking up and flipping the light switch in the bathroom?
I mean, it is. And the reason is that I wouldn't throw it out. I'd get it fixed. Okay.
But,
and
but
even though I'm Jewish, so I can't fix anything except people's heads and their lives. But don't ask me to put you know, your shelves up, because you won't have a wall when I'm done. But having said that, is that my father could fix anything. And generally that generation, I'm 60, so you know, he died a few years ago at 96 or 97. He could fix anything, and most of the people in his generation could fix anything. We've stopped learning how to fix things. I mean, people from the 50s fixed their own cars.
I'll give you that, but I still think that even pre-internet, like even in the 80s, 70s, 60s, we were still living in a kind of quasi-magical world that relied on so much technology that almost none of us actually understood how those technologies worked. Most people you pulled over, asked them how their car was running, they would have no idea how to tell you how a car works or how a toaster works or how even their toilet works, right?
I don't know if I, because I grew up in the 60s and 70s, you know, meaning I was from that generation. And we actually did know, and many, many, many of the kids knew how to fix everything that there was. But we also, what we didn't have is the magical thinking of that you could simply forget it, it's not relevant, and buy something to replace it. It had to be fixed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, I would give you that. I think that the movement absolutely has been toward invisibilizing our technologies, right? They become less and less, they're more apparent in our lives in some way, but how they're working is more and more invisible. So, for example, if you ask a child who spends 8 hours a day on the internet, if you ask them, where is the internet? They will have no idea how to even formulate that question, right? Mm. So I think that's that magic that you're talking about.
Which that's why it needs to be taught in school, because the bottom line is that we all know that the internet, the dangers in terms of stolen identities, in terms of any personal information is no longer personal. The hackers are becoming better and younger. Obviously, something needs to be taught, and there needs to be a balance. Because what parents are doing, in the same way the parents, and I'm not going to say they're bad parents, but the ones who didn't think things out, when I was a kid, they shoved their kids in front of Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers. But now they just give them a computer and say, look up, you know, whatever you want to. And Mr. Rogers, as boring as he was for me, was not harmful.
Very educational.
Yeah, it was very interesting, actually. Sesame Street was a little bit more interesting.
My mom was a teacher when Sesame Street first started being aired, and she tells me the story of all of her friends out at the school being afraid of Sesame Street, though, because how could they possibly compete with such an entertaining form of education, that kind of infotainment was sort of invented with Sesame Street.
Tell me what you would suggest to younger people to get their life balanced, and how should they approach social media? What are the do's and don'ts from your eyes?
Well, there's different levels of looking at it, right? There's the school curricula, right? Bringing critical studies, bringing history of media into our schools. That's, to me, a no-brainer. And if people are at schools where they're not teaching you the history of media, you should go out and teach it to yourself, right? There are a lot of fantastic books on the subject, more and more every year. But on a day-to-day kind of how do I live my life basis, I think talking to people who were alive before there was an internet can be massively educational, i.e. talking to your mom and dad. Because, you know, here's the scary thing, is we're the last generation in history that will remember what life was like before the internet. That means that whatever wisdom we have, it's going to die with us. And I think that younger generations would be kind of foolish not to download that wisdom or that experience while they still can. So
it's
just
interesting,
talk to mom and dad about what life was like.
Mike, but it's interesting the words you're using, that they should download it. Why can we not create a tradition of there's a balance between people actually sitting down and eating? There's a balance between, you know, actually talking to your parents and having them listen. In my generation, parents, you know, your kids are seen and not heard, go out and play. But now, you know, I live on the Upper East Side in Manhattan, and parents really spend a lot of time dialoguing with their kids, and I'm very impressed by it. Why does it have to be the end of human communication? Are we going to now start ordering brides on the internet?
I think a lot of people have already started doing that.
Well, you know, I mean, we have to also realize we live in a world where arranged marriages still outnumber people falling in love.
Well, there's a lot of Russian brides that are flying to New York, I think.
Yes, and they're doing it because they love the weather. but that's my question, meaning why can't we recognize the danger and realize the wisdom in the oral tradition, as Socrates recognized, it's really powerful, it's really intimate, and it really creates safety within a person. So why do we have to lose that?
I don't know that we do have to lose it. You know, here's the thing. The brain of a baby born today is not in any structural or fundamental way different from the brain of a baby that was born 10,000 years ago. Evolution, human evolution just doesn't work that fast. Let's not even say 10,000 years ago. Let's say 300 years ago.
Yeah, I would agree, because 10,000 years ago, that would not be true.
That's a bit much, maybe, but let's say 300 years ago. So, meaning an 18th century baby and a 21st century baby, these aren't different brains when they're born, really. So we always are able to use another tech word, reboot, right? We're always able to give our children an opportunity to view life on both sides of a certain media lens. The decision has to be ours, I think, in the end. So I don't buy that we're just over the cliff and there's no going back. Part of me hopes that we might be the most naive generation about online technologies, because we didn't know really what we had until it was running us over. But you know, I think that in the same way that people were a little bit naive about their food diets 50 years ago, and they became slightly more sophisticated about it more recently, we might become less naive about our media diets in the coming decades.
Which is why we need people who write books like you, you know, to give us, I'm serious, meaning it's why your message is extremely important, because there is the danger. I mean, let's face it. Technology has clearly made this world a much more dangerous place, because there's the possibility of one nuclear war to eliminate the human race.
Sure. Right?
We never had that before. We always had genocide throughout history. But in the same way there was genocide in one corner of the world, there was building communities in the other corner of the world. Now no one is really safe, because technology has brought us to the point where it's you know, we're dealing with people who, we're talking about brains not changing, whose brains are 20,000 years old, you know, because they, you know, they don't have any skills whatsoever, and they have the technology to start a third world war. I'm not going to mention names other than Kim Jong-un, but, you know, the bottom line is that we've created technology that can end the world, and people are kind of afraid of it. They're kind of afraid that paper money is going to disappear. They're kind of afraid that there is going, that Big Brother will be everywhere. They're afraid of losing anonymity and being able to just be at peace.
Well, I mean, this is what, I think it was Auden called it, the age of anxiety, right?
Right.
And I think that's what we're living in. We're living in an age of constant worry and anxiety.
That's why people come to see me, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's also the only age that we have and the only one that I know. I mean, were I, a Russian citizen during the Napoleonic Wars, I probably would consider it a pretty anxious time to be alive, too. I agree that we could probably destroy the planets in an afternoon if we felt like it. I don't know that if I had the opportunity that I would choose to be born in any other time, though. I think it's an extremely exciting time, partly because of the things that we're talking about right now. I mean, there has always been massive change that's occurred, but never massive technological change at the rate that we're experiencing it. So people within a single life get to live on both sides of something as big as the Gutenberg Revolution, you know? I don't know any other time in history that where a single person's life encompasses such a breadth of change. It's kind of marvelous.
I mean, you're right. And then what you said was so telling, because the truth is that people are more anxious and fearful now than almost at any other age. Now, of course, we could look at the Black Plague when what it was, 1/4 of Europe was wiped out.
Quarter, 1/4
of Europe. And of course, anyone living in that time, just like anyone living in any war anywhere, you know, you're in a state of trauma. But there was always a beginning and an end to something. Always wars began and ended. Technology is not ending. It's going to continue.
Okay? This is absolutely true. And I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the idea of Moore's Law.
Yes, I am.
But why
don't you explain it to our audience?
Basically, Moore's Law suggests that the speed of computer chips is going to, I think it's double every, how many years is it? Like every 7 years, every 3 years, or something like that?
It's actually increasing with time. That's the funny part about it, is that every time they try to make a calculation, they realize that they have to increase the speed by which the circuits are being doubled.
Right. So the gist of it is that we have exponential increases in the speed of our computers and of our technology.
Right, so, and then since Apple makes a phone every year, it's probably much quicker than 7 years. It's more like 1 year.
Sure.
Because they have technology now that a molecule, they could actually make a chip the size of a molecule, which is amazing.
So this is where you get to the idea of the singularity, right? When that axis starts to reach infinity and the speed of computation is almost infinite, some people argue that that's the point at which computers become sentient and they start to improve things for themselves. And at that point, humans maybe become irrelevant, or they become enslaved in a frightening matrix. I'm not sure I buy that. I think computation speed is not the only thing that you need for consciousness. But definitely there's that anxiety. I think that's part of that anxiety that you mentioned, is that our technologies are progressing at a rate so much faster than human comprehension can keep up.
And again, I agree with you, but what I said before about patients being lost, you know, when I first started my practice, the divorce rate was hovering around 20-25%. In Manhattan, the divorce rate is literally in the high 80s, low 90s. And nationally, it's well above 50%. So obviously, people have less patience and they have the throwaway mentality. They don't want to fix anything. It's just like, they wake up one morning and I'm not in love with you. Well, you know what? Love is like the tidal. It's like waves. It comes, it goes, it comes and goes. But you keep building through it.
I mean, okay, maybe for some people. But I mean, 100 years ago, if nobody was getting divorced, that might be because they were trapped in abusive relationships too, right? I mean, what you call a throwaway culture, what goes along with that is an idea of freedom or independence too, right? There's like kind of twin sides to the same problem.
I mean, that's true, but you know what? I see, you know, I deal with people all day long. I do a lot of executives, and they have not a single person who they could tell their most intimate thoughts to. And mm-hmm. when I was growing up, you did it with your friends.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So well, people I mean, have a lot of acquaintances, but no friends anymore.
Yeah. I have seen that in my research as well, that the number of psychologists call them, but basically true blue friends, you know, the number of people that you will confide in seems to have this drop, even while the number of followers or Facebook friends or whatever has this massive uptick. So it's, you know, it's quantity over quality.
Right, but the truth of the matter is there's some things that no one would tell anyone because once a person has that impression, there's no going back unless you absolutely, you know, feel a kinship that, you know, that could never be broken. And since I don't believe in unconditional anything,
I believe that's
why people come to see the people like me, so that anything they say just dies in that room.
I see. I mean, you're reminding me of there's a scene in that Brad Pitt movie, Meet Joe Black, where he's asking Brad Pitt, who's playing the figure of death, is asking somebody, how do you know that you love this woman? And he says, because she knows the worst thing about me, and it's okay. And that's his definition of love. And when you compare that to online friendships, it's very different, because the entire apparatus of connection online is a kind of advertising campaign for the self, right? You're constantly hiding the thing that is the worst thing about you. You're not confessing what is truly what you think is unattractive. There are a lot of confessions, but I think the people doing those confessions believe those confessions to be attractive or quirky or interesting. So you have a lot of sharing and not a lot of that more, say, Catholic idea of confessing what you really don't want people to know.
Absolutely. And a lot of people will not even confess to a priest, because they know that priests are not infallible and they talk among themselves, so on and so forth. Mike, the only thing I'm sad about right now is that we have to wrap. You are an amazing guest. You wrote an amazing book. And maybe in a later on we could actually pick up and do this again.
I'd love that. Thank you.
You're terrific. Have a great day, Mike.
Okay, you too.
Thanks, bye. Michael. Appreciate it. Cheers.
Thank you. Okay, see ya.
I want to once again thank Michael Harris. He had a cold today, but he did great, for joining us. Please do yourself a favor. Pick up his book at the local Barnes & Noble and online at Amazon.com. And check out his website. It is endofabsence.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck. Remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Check out all our other episodes on Gluck Radio. There is something for everyone. Check out the YouTube channel by searching for Errol Gluck. And, of course, you need to tell all your friends to listen to Gluck Radio and to visit my website, glucksolutions.org. Check out our Facebook page. Anything that you want to hear about, if you think that you can be a speaker on the show, give me a call. Thanks for listening. Till next time.